Hi guys, welcome to the next episode of Dot Game. In this episode, we're gonna continue our project by building out the inventory system, and then hopefully we'll get to hooking up the buy button. So this episode is gonna go over a lot of the fundamentals that we've already talked about, and it's just gonna start tying things together. I believe we'll talk about the event system a little bit more. We touched on it a bit in, I think it was part three or whenever we did the UI stuff. So we'll talk a little bit more in depth about the inventory system, but we'll be primarily coding and hooking everything up. So with that, let's go ahead and get started. What I have here is a few changes to the last time that you've seen the project. So rather than having you guys stare at me while I built up some of the UI components that we're working with, I went ahead and just set them up inside of the project, and we're going to focus primarily on the coding side of it. But I will walk you through how I set this up so that you can also do the same thing. So the first thing that we'll talk about is this player inventory screen. So what I did with this was, well, to be perfectly honest, I actually duplicated the store and then deleted things off of it. So I started from the store base, changed the sizing of it. I went through, let's actually switch to 2D, there we go. I went through and lowered the size of the text for the inventory header. The one that we had originally on the shop was just too large, so I picked a smaller text. I changed the size of the button because the anchors were set to a certain positioning within this window. When I reduced the size, it actually made this X button a little too small. So when you go to do this, if you happen to see your button and the X is hidden away and it's not there, it's really just that your button sizing is too small. So just make it a little larger and the X should come back. The next thing I did was I took the scroll view and I brought it up a bit. So on the store one, it goes all the way to the bottom. But as you can see, I wanted to add this footer in so we can track our bag space and then our currency on the bottom of the window. So I brought this up a bit. And then here's where the main change is. Under the viewport in the content, we had originally, I think it was vertical layout group, or vertical, oh geez. Let's see, now I'm butchering. Oh no, it was layout group. I don't know why I was thinking that was named something different. But on the original one, we had vertical layout group, and that was good for kind of paneling down and then being able to kind of adjust the height and width of the control kind of more dynamically, if you will. For the inventory, what we want is a set of boxes that kind of appear in a grid type of layout. So you can see here I've added the grid layout group. And you know, this will actually make a lot more sense if I drop in my prefab. So let's do this real quick and then I'll explain. Okay. So this is basically what the inventory screen will look like. And you can see I have a kind of a prefab inventory slot. And so I was going for more of like the traditional grid style layout where it kind of fills it all up basically just on a predefined cell type of sizing. So the grid layout group is a great component for that. The thing to note is you can only have a horizontal, a vertical, or a grid layout group. On the object. So I removed the horizontal, added the grid, and then you still have some of the same stuff that you had before. So we still have padding, and then we still have spacing. That was all the same on the last one. The difference now is we have this notion of a cell size. So we could increase these if we wanted to make these bigger or smaller, depending on kind of what size you want, or the positioning, if you will. The other areas to kind of note with the grid layout is we have these things called start corner, start axis, child alignment, and then constraint. So start corner is where the first element is located. So in this case, we have the kind of upper left. So it's the leftmost spot. I changed this around, but it'd be kind of hard to see since they're all the same. Start axis is the primary axis to place elements along. So for us, it's the horizontal. You could do vertical. Child alignment. So this is the alignment used for layout elements if they don't fill the space. And then the last is constraints. So if you happen to have a scenario where you only want a single column, you can fix that column count to be a certain amount. Same with row. So if we wanted it to, well, if we wanted two columns, you could just change that. So it lets you kind of fine tune it. Flexible is it'll just kind of fill the space out. So super handy component. That's the new one that you guys haven't seen before. Everything else on the scroll view is the same. And then the last thing that I did is I added a footer. So we have the header for the text, and then I've got a footer container. And inside that, I really just created a bag details kind of panel. As you can see, I turned off my image, like I said, I tend to do. So I have a little panel. And then the amount. So we're going to populate this. And the way that this amount is going to fill out is it'll show you your available space left compared to your total amount of bag space. And this is useful if I don't know, if you were building the game so that if your player's strength, maybe the higher the strength, the more items they could carry, or if you had like a bag equipment thing so they could switch out bags to get more slots. So the idea is that the amount of bag slots you have could fluctuate along with, of course, how many items you actually have in your inventory. And then the other area that I did was the coin details. So I kind of just, rather than having the dynamic area of, oh, if I have enough copper, it's there, and if I have enough silver, it's there, I just opted for listing all of these elements out. You could go either way. Instead of filling it, you could kind of have it dynamically calculate it. And then I think that's really it for this inventory screen. So the other thing that I added was a button down at the bottom. So we needed a way to open and close the inventory screen, and we could tie that to the keyboard, which we will, but I thought it might also be nice to tie it to an actual button. So to do that, I added a new row at the bottom called interface icons, and I just had it take up, I think it's something like 25% of the screen space. And then I added this button with this inventory icon that I made. Now, a few things to look at here that I did that we haven't talked about before. So I have the source image, which is swap bag. So it's this bag image right here. And then what I did is for the transition, I set it to sprite swap. So it's usually set to color tint, where if you hover over it, you'll see it kind of tint in a darker color. In this case, I wanted to actually swap out the sprite when it's highlighted or pressed to be to light up a little bit and to be darker. So you can kind of see when I hover, there's a little, little kind of lighter shadow thing to highlight it, and then you see it kind of tint dark. So it's actually swapping out a sprite as opposed to applying just a color or a tint to it. So pretty easy to set up in terms of the transition. You can also do an animation if you wanted to do that as well. The rest of this I think we'll end up talking about as we build it out. So I think that's really about it for the things that I've changed. Actually, I lied. There's one more thing. I renamed, so I think the script originally for the merchant inventory was, I actually don't remember what I called it. I think it was just inventory or inventory details. I refactored it to say merchant inventory details because we're going to do a player inventory details. So I wanted to kind of separate it out because they'll have different behavior tied to them as we start to kind of grow the scriptable objects or really grow the behavior out. So that's really the other thing. As you see me reference merchant inventory details, that was the one I think formerly known as just inventory or inventory details. And that's about it. So let's get going. Okay. So the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to create a UI controller to handle the input for the interface. So we'll create a new class. We'll call this player inventory UI controller. And then, actually, I'll leave this in the namespace because I think everything else might actually be in that. Unfortunately, I have a mismatch of namespaces that I need to go through and fix. That just is a byproduct of how I end up creating the scripts. If I create them inside of Unity, then it usually drops the namespace. If I do them inside of Visual Studio Solution Explorer, it adds it. which creates a little bit of inconsistency, unfortunately. So we'll do using Unity Engine. This is going to be mono behavior based. Because we're going to have this. So this is going to live on, it's actually going to live on our button. But it's going to handle feeding in information to this screen. So the button's going to handle the notion of the input, calling the screen, and whatnot. And that's primarily because if we have the logic in, say, update that says, oh, hey, if you know somebody presses the B button, enable me, well, if this is hidden or disabled, then that code will never actually run, which would be problematic for showing it. So to do this, we're going to first need a reference to the player inventory window. We'll add an awake method. And we're going to do, we're basically going to go and get the parent. And I'll show you why this is in a second on the hierarchy. Okay, so basically what we're doing is we're getting the reference to our player inventory window, and we're saying, hey, transform, go to my parent, and if we look at the hierarchy, this will live right here. So it's parent, and then we're going to go up another layer to this parent, and then we're going to start to go down. So we're going to go up to this, and then we're going to look for player inventory window, and then we're going to grab the game object as its reference. So you go up twice, and then down the once. And then the next thing we'll do is we're going to actually, for consistency's sake, we'll do private. We're going to monitor for the button. Oops. All right. Input.getKey down. Key code. So this is another way. I think we looked at the access stuff previously. Another thing that you can do is just hook it straight to a button. So you'd want to avoid this if you're providing a mechanism for the user to change what buttons map to certain things. Then you'd want to go the input and the access thing that we reviewed before. If you don't care, which in this case, I'm kind of being lazy, so I don't really care, you can map it to a specific key. So I'm going to go B for bags. Depends on the game or the RPG style you're used to. This could be I for inventory, P for player, C for character, or H for hero. I think those are all like the main games that I play. Nobody standardizes, and for some reason I gravitate more towards B for bag, so that's the route we're going here. So what we're going to do is inside of this, we're going to want to toggle the window. But before we can do that, we're going to actually need a method to call. So let's create one. So the point of this method is going to be to set the window active, to change the active state. So what we're basically going to do is set the window active to be basically the opposite of whatever it is. So we'll do not player window active self. So just be the opposite of whatever our current state is. Which is a handy trick and quite useful for the majority of scenarios. I've actually gotten into some trouble where I was behaving off of this toggle, but for some reason, I think my code, my logic just got a little too complicated, so my toggle got a little wonky. So just something to kind of be aware of when you're doing the toggle, that the state of sometimes you do want to, I guess, generally drive it as open or closed, and you can get a little complicated. So it's really an as-needed basis on in terms of just like the catch-all scenario. Okay, so we've got awake, we have a reference, we're checking for if the B button is down, and then we're going to toggle the window. In theory, it should actually work. I'm pushing B. Nothing is happening. And the reason is the script doesn't actually live anywhere. I forgot to drop it on the object. So, what did I call this? I think it was like player inventory, UI controller. Okay, now let's try again. There we go. So I'm pushing B, it's toggling it back and forth. If you see we click on this button, nothing happens. An easy fix for that is to just add the on-click reference. So you can drag again to work with the inspector version of the UI, and in a little bit we'll actually look at how you can do this programmatically. But for the inspector version of the on-click, you just drag the game object, and then you want to pick your that the script lives on that has the method that you want to this area. And then you look for the method, pick that. First we'll save, and so now we'll see, this is there. So really what, I kind of use this highlighted sprite and disabled sprite, which is great, but I think the effect that I would have liked is if it was open, it changes to that state, and if it's closed, it changes off of it. Whereas now you can kind of see, it's when I click off of the button that it changes the state. So. We've looked at the techniques. I'm not going to solve that now, but we've looked at all of that. So you could add some logic in toggle window if you wanted to go kind of above and beyond, and if you cared about that, that basically just checked, hey, if we're active, make this sprite, you know, X, and if we're not active, then turn us back to normal. It's actually a pretty simple fix. And then you could just change this back over to the highlight if you wanted. Okay, so now we've toggled that on. Let's move over to adding some logic for addressing a bug. So if we hide this away, if we notice when I click this button, oh, I still have the logic in here. So when we click that button, you're not seeing her navigate because I actually already have the logic. I forgot to remove this from here, but let me delete something so that you can see. Don't look at this. Pretend like you don't see it. Okay. So if you remember in one of the older episodes, we added logic for the store UI. When we were clicking, the Raycast was going through the UI and she was navigating. Now, by default, when we go to set this up to click on the button, the same thing is going to happen. But rather than locking off the movement, there's a different way that you can tackle this problem, which is through the event system. So, again, we talked about the event system very briefly in the UI episode. It's basically responsible for processing and handling events in the Unity scene. You can see the game object right here. It gets added automatically, or most of the time. I don't know for sure if I've ever actually seen it not get added out automatically if I goofed and accidentally deleted it somewhere. But it should get added automatically when you add the UI, any component on the UI. If it doesn't, there's this event system, so you can add it in through that way. But basically, you can think of it as a way of sending events to objects based off of input, based on input. So input covers keyboard, mouse, touch, or really even your own custom. And it consists of a few components that work together. So if we're looking at this event system, you can see it's got the event system script. Then we have this standalone input module. So the event system has a couple of roles. One is to manage which game object is considered selected. So we kind of saw that happening when I was doing the button. The other is which input module to use. So you can use this. So you can technically make your own. An input module is basically a way of handling input or managing the event state and sending events to scene objects. The other thing that it does is handles the ray casting. So if we look at the canvas, we can see that there's this graphic ray caster on it. That's basically used for figuring out what the pointer is over. The graphic ray caster is the version of ray casting that you would use for UI elements. We've taken a look at some of the other ones for 2D physics, or not, I'm sorry, we haven't taken a look at 2D physics for the 3D physics, but there's also ray casting for 2D physics. So basically, to kind of recap, the event system works by kind of combining inputs or things that it's getting from the standalone input module, as well as the graphic ray caster to kind of detect and process events that are happening in the scene. So for the store, we want to keep that same behavior that we had where the movement was locked, because we still don't want the person to walk away from the merchant with that screen open, right? Or we could let them walk away, and then within a certain distance, you have it automatically closed. That's another option. But with the inventory, or really not even so much the inventory window, the buttons that are going to be down at the bottom bar, we don't want to lock the player's movement or handle toggling between that. We really just want to do a check to see if we are over one of those objects. So the way that we can do that with blocking the movement, actually, let me show you what I mean. We walk kind of over here. If I click this button, you can see it's toggling, but we're also still navigating to wherever it is that I'm clicking. So we can prevent that from happening. If we come back over here and we look at movement controller, I'd actually already had this, but you put if you put the using Unity Engine event systems on here, that gives you access to work with the event system. What we can just do is another check. So we can do, in addition to if our button is down and if movement's not locked, if we're going to just basically say if the pointer, if event system dot current, so if the current event system is pointer, is not over a game object that's part of the event system, then we continue. So this kind of just does that final check to make sure that we're not trying to click on in a button or something else within the UI. So if we come back over here, we click around, you can see we're still moving. We click on this, she's not navigating to it anymore, which is handy. So it's another good approach to kind of making sure that you don't continue to execute logic based off of Raycast when you're clicking on a button. All right, so that handles kind of the basics of our toggling. The next thing that we want to do is start to work with our player inventory. So we're going to create another scriptable object. We're going to do that under item. We will call this player inventory details. And we'll call you script, or no, I have to. There we go. Turn it public. So this is going to house that data. So we'll cover the, we'll have a list of items. This will be the inventory items. So we'll keep kind of a raw reference to those items. We're also going to have an amount of copper coins. So this is a big difference. Just get us out of that. There you go. So the copper coins is a difference in how we are handling the logic for our individual items. So we have a bit of a mismatch, and rather than refactoring it, we're just going to add a couple helper methods that allow us to do a difference. So if you remember, the individual items are tracking currency based off of, let's actually show you. It's going to yell at me. It's okay. So we look at the wizard hat. We were tracking the purchase price based off of individual elements, and we were specifying the copper coin and the silver coin. In hindsight, the way that I probably would have designed this, and I think I talked about it originally, but I kind of kept going down the path that I was going just for demonstration purposes, I would have really just tracked one coin and done it in copper, kind of the smallest value, and then done the conversion ad hoc for silver and gold. But because we went down this path, rather than doing too much refactoring in a single episode, we're going to keep this as its separate elements, and then we're going to track the player inventory details the correct way as the single coin element, and then we're going to just have a couple helper methods that will allow us to either translate to the gold, silver, copper breakdown, or the full copper value breakdown. So that doesn't make sense. I promise it will. Momentarily, or not momentarily, but by the end of the episode. So we have our copper coins, and we're going to do, so our total bag slots, we're really not going to have much of the logic that I was describing earlier. That's more up to you to kind of go and play around with. For now, we're just going to hard code in whatever our total bag slots are. But this will set the stage for if you did want to put that logic in, reading it out of a single property. The other thing that we'll do is we're going to build our helper method, one of them that I was describing. So we're going to build a method that basically splits out the coins into the gold, the silver, and the copper. values so that we can display that on the UI. So the way we'll do that, so we're going to create an array with, we're going to set it all to 0 to start, and then I don't like getting yelled at, so I have a tendency to do my return at the end, but right away. Okay, so basically what we'll do is the 0th element is going to be our copper. And the way that we can figure that out is if we do copper coins modulo 99. So the conversion is every 100 is 1 silver. So every 100 copper coins is 1 silver. Every 100 silver coins is a gold coin. So pretty standard conversion. So the way that we decide our, or we get our copper coins, is we need to know what's the remainder that's left over for our initial division, and that gives us the end result. So then the next one is gets a little bit more complicated, not tremendously, but a little bit more as we go. So for our silver, it's still copper coins divided by 99. And then we want the remainder of that as well. So we're going to go up a level, and then we're going to grab the remainder of it for our silver. And then for the gold, we're going to go, actually want the whole number. So we go copper coins divided by 99, and then we're going to divide that again by 99 and just take the whole result, and that's going to give us our gold coins. So that's it. So now we have our helper method. We're tracking our inventory items, we're tracking our total copper coins, and our total bag slots. And because this is a scriptable object, so it's going to get serialized, and it's going to remember our data points. So we don't need to worry about working with player prefs, which if you're familiar with Unity, you've learned about. If you're not familiar with Unity, we probably really should cover at some point, so I'll try and figure out a good way to work that into an episode. But the point is, you don't have to do any extra mechanisms to kind of save the state of this because we're using the scriptable objects. That's one of those added benefits tied to it. Okay, so now what we're gonna do, get rid of movement controller, we're going to keep building out our UI controller. So in particular, we're gonna start to populate the actual UI. So the first thing we want to do is, instead of having these predefined bag spaces, we want to actually loop through our bag count and then put the amount of slots in that we actually have. So I'm going to delete those out. We're going to save it so we don't have anything that's kind of starting. And then I'm going to add void. So I'm going to add start. And for a quick refresher, Awake will always run regardless on if the script is active or disabled on the component. If it exists, it will run. Start will only run after the script has been enabled or activated for the first time. So if you have a script that's on a game object and it's turned on by default, Awake will run, then Start will run. If it's shut off, then Awake will run, and then Start will only run the first time that the script becomes enabled. So Start wouldn't run, but once you do enable it, it'll run once. That might sound a little confusing, but if you just add, like the thing I recommend is very similar to Unity Engine. What you saw me do in, I think it was the basic episode, where I often recommend that you just create an empty script, add awake, add start, add update, fixed update, kind of all of those typical mono behaviors, and just add some debug logic in it and turn them off. So toggle them back and forth, and you'll kind of see the state in which they activate, which will make a lot of it make a lot more sense, I guess. Okay, so coming back to, let's get you. There we go. Bugging me. Actually, all of my organization here is, there we go, bugging me. Okay, so in start, what we're going to do, actually, we need a reference private. We're going to store a reference to the bag space text, because this is something that's going to need to get updated, right? As we
sell or buy new items, the backspace availability text will need to get changed. So it's easiest if we set a reference to that. And then if we do a reference to grab the actual reference in, as part of Awake, very similar to what we did with the inventory window. So we're just going to grab it right away and then work with it when the time comes. So player inventory, oops. This keyboard is just driving me bonkers. I really just need to type on this thing more. Player inventory. So we can base this off of the window. We're going to do find child. So the reason I'm basing it off of the window is so that we don't have to do this every single time. We already have a reference. We know it's there, or at least it should be. If not, we've got bigger problems. Technically, we could wrap this in a null check. If we wanted. There we go. So now we have the bag space check. So we're just going to go from the window into the footer, the bag details, the amount, and we're going to grab the text. Okay, I said the wrong word there. That's okay. So inside of start, we're going to do bag space dot text. And we're going to do a format of the string. So we'll go 0/1. We'll pass in two parameters. The first is basically our, I don't have a reference to, we'll call you, I don't have a reference to the player inventory details. Actually, I don't think we need this to be public. Private. There we go. So what we're going to want to do, there we go. Need the total bag slots that we were calculating. We're actually going to subtract the inventory items dot count from it. So that's basically going to give us, bring this on another line so you can see, that's going to give us how many slots are left, essentially. And then we have player inventory details.bag slots. So again, we're going to format the string. Our first parameter is just a quick calculation of how many slots we have available, left, I should say. And then the last one is just the total amount of bag slots that we have. The next thing that we want to do is we want to iterate through the separate this out a bit. So we want to iterate through the total amount of bag slots that we have allocated and add the or instantiate the game object to fill out that grid. So doing that is pretty easy, but we are going to need, private game object. We will call this, item templates. Oops. And then we're going to want, we're going to need a reference of the scroll view that we want to add this template in. So very similar to what we did in the store. So we'll add those. I'm going to serialize this top one. So by serializing the field, that gives us access to a private variable on the inspector. That way we can drop our prefab that I had created before, which I just realized I didn't talk about. So before we push play, I'll just talk about how that was built. It's pretty straightforward. And then we need to, for the scroll view content, we're going to want to do something very similar. So we'll change this out. Our path is going to be different. And then, of course, we don't want the text. Where are we living? I think it's, we'll be up at the player inventory. We're going to go scroll view, viewport, and content, I think. So we'll go that. And then content, and hope I don't spell anything wrong. And then we can drop the text reference because we're not storing that. And this will pull the transform out by default. So all we're doing is just creating a quick reference to this, which is going to allow us to add, and then if we wanted to go and clear them out for whatever reason, we could also do that. So jumping back into our start logic. Now what we want to do is we're going to iterate. So we're going to do for, what is it? Player inventory total bag slots. So we're just going to count up to our bag slots. And then we're going to go game object. We're going to do a normal instantiation like we've done before. And we'll do the item template. And then the scroll view content is our parent. And then we'll hit the same thing that we hit before, at least most likely, where when you instantiate it, it kind of messes with the scale. So we're just going to, local scale. We're going to just target that right away and get rid of it. We'll just make sure that it's set to 1. And that should give us... That should give us our bag slot. So let's take a look and see what happens. I think I know what I was about to miss. So I don't have the item template in here. Let's talk about that real fast. This is the other thing that I added that I didn't talk about. So it's super straightforward. It's basically just an image component that has the UI indent. And then inside of it is another image called item image. I kept it in line with what we were calling the stuff for the item store container. And that's just, again, another image, but it's brought in by 5x5x5. And that's what creates kind of that indent look. This is essentially the exact same thing setup that we had on the item store container that we were displaying on the store stuff. So it's very, very similar to that, similar look. Okay, let's push play. We've broken it already. Of course we have. Oh, I still didn't drop the reference. So this null reference is yelling at me because I didn't drop the template in or create a reference to the thing that it needs to instantiate. So I can fix that by dragging it. And then if we push play again, we're still airing out. Not sure why. Let's see. That's the other thing. I don't know if you guys just saw that, but what I find is doesn't happen all the time. Sometimes, even with that logic of the event system, when you go to click, it'll still calculate the movement. As far as I can tell, it seems to be in relation to how quick I'm clicking on the button compared to how fast I'm starting how soon the play mode has entered. If I do it too fast, it seems like it still does the it's like it hasn't fully initialized or something, and it'll still do the click, and then it just doesn't do that anymore. So I'm not entirely sure. It's super weird. Okay. This is yelling at us here for some reason. And I guess let's take a look and see what I broke. Do some debugging. Push and play. There we go. We did hit it. Okay. So we do have a reference to our bag text. I like to do is just make sure it found it. It's got a mount. We've got the text. Let's just do some checks here. Not sure why it would be. Oh! Oh, this is a silly one. Okay. I know why it's upset. And it is upset because it doesn't have a reference to the inventory details. I never created the object or tied it to it. So this is another area we're going to serialize the field. There we go. And then we're actually going to create data. And I didn't even reference that top bar, so let's steal. Why write more than once? Let's steal this. We have no way to create it through the asset menu because I didn't tag it with the right attributes. So we'll go item. We'll call this player inventory. And then we'll also say player inventory data. And now we can create it. Item. Not here. Didn't. I think I just saw it go. Nope. Why are you yelling? Oh, geez. Wrong script. That would be a good reason why. Here. I'm just going to say it's early in the morning. Oops. So early in the morning that I'm playing when I didn't mean to do that. Okay. There we go. Now it's there. So we'll call this, we'll just leave it player inventory data. I think we're going to say no for the inventory items for now. Let's give copper, actually, let's go. I don't know. Hopefully, I think it's something like 24,000 should bleed into the gold, I think. And then bag slots, I don't know, let's go 15. 15 feels like a good number. And then if we come back over to this, we'll reference our player inventory data. Push play. There we go. We're not making really silly mistakes. We can see that we have our inventory stuff is filled out. Looks like we've got 3x5 grid, so 15 items. If we were to go 16, our scroll bar would activate, which is as we expected. We can also see that we have 15 of 15 slots available. That might be a little misleading, depending on, I guess, if you're used to seeing the amount of fill tied to it. I do feel like I did that opposite, but you can change that, I guess, if you prefer the other side. But we can see that the number is being populated, which is the good thing. So if we, let's add one reference to something. We'll just do a health potion, or I guess I did a mana potion. We push play. We'll see. It is calculating it properly. So we see the 14 of 15. All right, guys, we're going to go ahead and wrap up this episode here. We're not going to do a challenge at the end of this one. The next episode, at the end of that, the challenge will kind of encompass a lot of the logic that we've looked at in this video. And then, of course, they're going to kind of wrap up in the next one. So thanks for joining, and I'll see you next time.